Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Murat Egan, the Stanford Calderwood Endowed Chair in Economics at the University of Colorado in Boulder, where he specializes in the economics of the family, economic development and growth, and cleometrics. Professor Egan also serves as a research fellow at the Institute for the Study of Labor in Bonn, Germany, and is a founding fellow of the Association for Analytical Learning on Islam and Muslim Societies. In previous days, he served as a staff economist at the Federal Reserve Board in Washington, D.C. While Murat's research has been published in prestigious journals such as the American Economic Review, Quarterly Journal of Economics, the Review of Economic Studies, it is his latest book from the University of Chicago Press that we are most interested in today. The title of that work is War, Peace, and Prosperity in the Name of God, The Ottoman Role in Europe's Socioeconomic Evolution. Of course, and as always, you can find a link to that book and other interesting tidbits about Murat, plus related podcasts, back at our website, www.researchonreligion.org. It should be proclaimed that writing books and articles is only one facet of this Renaissance man. Murat is also a guitarist in a blues band called Barrel of Blues that can be found performing in and around the likes of Boulder and Denver. And if y'all are good and listen intently to our discussion today on religion and economic development, we will give you a taste of his musical stylings at the end of this interview. That's right, we here at Research on Religion not only fill your cranium with edumacation, but we will get your toes a-tapping with some down-home rhythm and blues. Murat, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony. It's great to be on your podcast. Thank you.
I have to start off by asking about cleometrics. What the heck is cleometrics? Is that the measure of people named Cleo?
Well, in my case, maybe Cleo and Cleopatra. You know, the shorthand for it is it's basically quantitative economic history, where it's economic history with special emphasis on data and statistical analysis, trying to quantify some of the theories or hypotheses that are the focus of economic history.
Very cool. And that is what you are doing a lot in the book that you've just written, War, Peace, and Prosperity in the Name of God. And it's a really interesting mix of economic history as well as what your quantitative history, but it's also extremely readable, I should note for folks. I know when people hear economics, they go, oh my gosh, there's going to be a lot of those strange formulas and all that kind of stuff. But no, this is actually a very readable book and I recommend it to folks. And I have been excited to see it come out because I followed some of your research in the past. And so this is a nice culmination of several different papers that you've been working on and have published over the past few years.
I appreciate it.
So, now regular listeners to this podcast will know that I like to think of myself as a political economist of religion, that we also feature a number of economists who study religion. So, I know some of you are going to hear that I have another economist on the show. That should be of no surprise. However, we oftentimes get new listeners here, and they might be a bit freaked out by somebody who is supposed to be studying supply and demand curves for wheat and cork is off there venturing into the world of spirituality and the faithful. How did you, as an economist, a labor economist, ever get started into looking at the topic of religion?
Yeah, so I did my graduate work in the 90s at Brown when the late Herschel Grossman was a prominent member of the faculty, and he at that point switched to solely focusing on political economy topics. One of the things that he was working on that really drew my attention was this idea that, you know, economists typically take, neoclassical economists, that is, they take the production environment as given, where you have property rights pretty well defined, and the focus is typically on how resources are allocated to productive uses. what Herschel was pushing back then, along with a couple of others at different universities, was the idea that we should perhaps take a step back, especially when we're interested in political economy topics, and consider not only the allocation of resources to production, but also to extra-legal uses and even violence. To me, this was an eye-opener, and I worked with Herschel on a couple of papers. I wrote a couple of papers on my own. And through serendipity or, you know, interest that intervened in other topics, I basically abandoned that research for about a decade until around 2005. Then two things really happened and led to research that eventually culminated with the book. One was in especially development economics, macro development economics, we saw the rise or rebirth, let's say, of institutional economics, new institutional economics, based on empirical, very exciting empirical research, novel, I should add, by the likes of Danny Roderick and Daron Acemoğlu, Simon Johnson and Robinson, that basically brought formal, you know, institutions, legal institutions, to the table as an important determinant of economic development. So, to be honest, and you'll see as we talk about this, I'm a little bit skeptical of that view in the sense that I do believe institutions are important, but I tend to view institutions as a continuum that goes all the way back to beliefs in formal institutions and the links between those and culture and how they then manifest themselves in the rules of the game, the explicit rules of the game. So I really started to focus on that aspect. And the other thing that really changed and made me come back to this research, in all honesty, was September 11th, where we, you know, our world changed in many ways living in the U.S. and elsewhere. But it again brought to the fore this idea that ideology is important and, you know, the interactions between West and East could be influenced in dramatic ways. So those, combining those two things, I started to focus on European history, to look at the precedence of the relationship between important Islamic civilizations and Europe.
I noticed that you also published a lot with Avner Greif, who is one of these people who starts to think deeply about economic history as well as institutions and also brings in the cultural component of it. And he's one of my favorite political economists there.
Yes, indeed, indeed. I mean, it's no coincidence. You know, we work with Avner on different topics. But precisely, Avner's view of institutions, where he takes very seriously the underlying beliefs, the informal networks, the informal rules of the game, and how they complement and interplay with formal, explicit rules of the game in institutions, is something that had appealed to me. And, you know, eventually we started working with Avner, too, on these related topics. And that kind of idea where, you know, some underlying ideology, culture, beliefs, come to impinge upon, you know, actual institutions is very much at the heart of the book.
I have to read the subtitle of the book. It's The Ottomans' Role in Europe's Socioeconomic Evolution. And your approach to this is rather novel, as we will see, because most people tend to look at the Europe impact on the Ottoman Empire. You're reversing that in your book. Whatever motivated you to ask that question or to figure out this puzzle?
Yeah, I mean, so really the book, in my opinion, the book is a purely positive analysis of what is and what happened. So the Ottoman and European relationships and the impact of Ottomans on Europe's, you know, socio-political and economic institutions was really the culmination of the earlier ideas in the book. So if I have to basically summarize, the book is focused on three, you know, fundamental questions. One, why and how did political power and organized religion become so swiftly and successfully intertwined? And in this respect, I'm going to focus especially on monotheisms. And then, what has been the role of religion in ideology and conflict historically, to sort that out. And finally, based on that, if we identify certain patterns regarding conflict and religion, were there some lasting sociopolitical, demographic, and economic effects of these religiously motivated conflicts? These are the three fundamental questions that the book tries to answer. And in short, if I had to give you the key punchlines, one is that you know, I do find and argue that, you know, especially monotheisms, the Abrahamic versions, were very successful and efficient in combining religious and political authority, and we will talk about how that came about. Based on that, once these monotheisms became entrenched and spread so successfully geographically, due to the inherent one God, one religion aspect duality, the so-called duality inherent in them, it led to eventual conflict, is one of my arguments. And due to that conflict, which is exemplified in some ways historically in Europe by the confrontations of the Ottoman Empire with European powers, I argue that that had lasting effects in Europe as well as the Middle East, and hence the subtitle of the book.
Yeah. I also have to ask, too, and this is based on your name. Folks will hear me pronounce it at the beginning of the podcast as Egan, and that sounds like a good Irish name, but if you look on our website, it is written I-Y-I-G-U-N, and that's not an Irish name. You're
not at all. Yeah, not at all. It's actually in Turkish. It just means good day.
Oh, well, that's a great name to have. Good day.
Exactly.
Okay. Very good. So, yeah, you are of Turkish heritage, and
yes.
So that probably, you know, the history there, so you're the person to be dealing with this, which I think is very cool. So let's go ahead and dig into the questions. And one of the questions that you bring up and that you already mentioned is the why and how monotheisms become swiftly intertwined with political and state authority. And you focus on monotheisms. In the first part of your book, you compare monotheisms, particularly the Abrahamic faiths of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, with the polytheist religions, paganism of the days of old and others, in terms of social control or social stability, as you sometimes call it as well. And again, you're a cleometrics guy, so you're gonna bring some data to this. And you set out to measure this relationship. Tell us a little bit about this, and what did you find about monotheisms and social stability?
Yes. So let's do it in parts. First, let's talk about the data and, like, my basic findings, and then we can, you know, go back to, well, why and how did maybe monotheisms produce these effects? Of course, you know, whenever you deal with things like this, data, definitions, there are always murky gray areas involved, and you have to make subjective calls. And especially with very ambitious, grandiose topics like this, you're even bolder and more ambitious. So that comes at a cost. I have to acknowledge that up front. But what I tried to do here is to say, once I had this hypothesis that, and in fact, the role of religion, the socio-political stability, the social benefits of religion and faith, obviously are very old, you know, established ideas dating back to the turn of the 20th century sociologists. Right, Emile Durkheim, Auguste Comte, David Hume, all those guys talked about religion in general, not necessarily monotheism, and we can get to monotheism later. But once I had this idea that, you know, religion, and especially monotheism, was perhaps, you know, especially potent in combining political authority and religious authority, I decided, well, I need data, and to be able to speak and see what the data can tell us. So, as part of that goal, what I did was to go back in history and dig into the atlases and all the relevant sources, is to come up with a catalog, very descriptive data set of past human civilizations starting in 2500 BC to the advent of nation states around the mid 18th century. Now, of course, there are lots of issues here. How do you define human civilization and political authority? Were they independent? What is the size? And lots of calls that I had to make, a lot of them subjective, some of them easier to defend, some of them not so. But in the end, I ended up with nearly 280 human civilizations that came and went, and some of them are still here today. And given that it goes back this far, you know, ideally, I'd want some socioeconomic, political indicators, concrete variables that we could look at, that political economists, you know, sociologists have typically focused on: per capita incomes, mortality, life expectancy, some obvious measures of general well-being. Those, of course, are not available when you go back that far. What I was able to do is to focus on two things that I could measure. One, how long did these civilizations last? And two, at their peak political power, what was the overall geographic territorial control that was attributed to these civilizations? So focusing on those two outcomes alone, then I tried to see and trying to control for some other key things that could affect these outcomes, such as how big, you know, countries became and how long they lasted. I tried to see if a majority of their populations embracing a monotheist faith did impact these outcomes. And what I did find very crudely is, number one, yes, I mean, those countries that for the most part subscribe to a monotheism did last longer, everything else equal, and they tend to control larger geographic domains. With the former, I didn't find any differences between Christianity and Islam. Of course, Judaism is there, but it's always a small part of the this sample, the data set. So I think de facto what I say here is mostly about Christianity and Islam. The other thing that I found is that, unlike the impact on duration, in terms of geographic control and territorial conquest, countries that embraced Islam really had an extra kick.
Mm-hmm. I have to ask about that. And I'm going to compliment you on doing this, because in terms of quantitative analysis, the task that you're undertaking is monumentally difficult. I mean, again, you're going back 4,000, 5,000 years almost, yeah, to try to gather data, and it's just not there, right? So the scholar has to be very creative. And I thought the use of the duration of the empire or of the civilization and the geographic scope was actually very creative. It's a brilliant idea. It's the best that you can possibly do with the data that you have. But one of the questions that I had when I'm reading the book, and I'm thinking about things like the Umayyad dynasty, yes, and caliphate, it expanded really far, I mean thousands of miles across northern Africa and into the, yes, Middle East. And you could say, well, yeah, they had really good geographic dispersion, but how strong a control was that? Was it easy for the Umayyads to actually rule parts of, right, Western North Africa or even Spain or anything like that? What are your thoughts on that? How good of a variable is that geographic expanse, I guess, is why I'm asking.
Yeah, no, very legitimate point. You know, not only with the Umayyads, some of these Arab, you know, empires, but also in the case of the Ottoman Empire, coming back to the, you know, to later decades and centuries around the 17th and 18th even, you know, to what extent they controlled Egypt, the Middle East, you know, Saudi Arabia is always subject to debate. And, you know, and I totally sympathize with these issues. And so I don't have much to say on this, except for the fact that, you know, let's take the Ottoman Empire and the control over Egypt. You know, once they conquered Egypt, they did have a governor in place, and it was all about taxation and paying taxes due to the Ottoman Empire. A lot of historians would argue, beyond that, Egypt was almost always independent, and I sympathize with that. But just the fact that, historically speaking, we are able to attribute, you know, general control and some flow of resources to the metropolis of the empire, to me, is basically sufficient to say, okay, you know, at some level there was some force exerted, and this territory became, you know, loyal, fiscally at least, to the big empire. So, I mean, that's as much as I can say. The other thing I can say in defense, even though these are all important issues and make your data less reliable, to some extent, to me, the key issue would be whether, due to monotheism, this control really changed, right? So if, historically speaking, you have this so-called, you know, I'm going to get a little bit technical here, although I don't like it, if measurement error, right, we have significant measurement error in ascribing territorial control, but that error doesn't really vary by whether the empire was monotheist or not, then the findings I have are really not tainted. And that's what I really basically, you know, subscribe to here.
I think that's a great answer, because as I tell my students in political science classes when you really want to understand political history, economic history. It's war and taxes, war and taxes, war and taxes, war and taxes, right? And you make a very good point here is that, well, you know, in the outer expanses of an empire, yeah, they kind of doing things on their own. But if they're still paying taxes, if they're still tithing and paying tribute to the core of the empire, yeah, you're not so independent as you might think. And so that,
Exactly. I mean, it reflects the history of a relationship there. That, yeah, you know, you're pretty much independent. You want to keep this big empire at bay, and historically they've exerted some power. So instead of confronting them and messing with that power structure, you pay the taxes and they let you be in exchange. But that still demonstrates an advantage that the empire has over the territory, which in my case was good enough to grab that and run with it.
Absolutely. One of the other methodological critiques somebody could bring up as well is that you're dealing with a very long period of time, 4,000, 5,000 years. And one could make an argument that says, well, you know, over time, it got easier to rule larger territories. I mean, 5,000 years ago, you had to basically walk to all your different territories or take a horse or something. That took a long time. But, you know, when you're getting into the 1500s, 1600s or so, transportation, still difficult, is a little bit easier. So are we really just seeing effect of technological change in terms of this and that there's a spurious correlation, or did you somehow adjust for this?
Oh, yeah. Excellent point, Tony. Yeah, I mean, I did try to control for these things, right? And it's interesting because whenever we make these statements in this quantitative research, we say everything else equal. And one of the things that really is salient when you look at the book and the data is that over time, there are big time trends. Over time, we see, in fact, that empires lasted less. You know, duration is through time declining. Territorial control, too. I mean, typically countries were getting smaller despite some of the things that you mentioned, you know, due to technological change and military technologies and so forth. It could have been easier to control bigger territories. I find the opposite, but in this research that I'm doing in trying to quantify whether monotheism really affected the duration and the territorial control of civilizations, I try to control for those things. It would have been ideal, in fact, if over time I had really markers, and you could do this too, but it's very crude. Again, you know, my starting point, unfortunately, is crude, but, you know, it's such an important topic that I wanted to take a stab at it anyway. You know, if you had really markers in terms of what were the key technological innovations, when did they arrive, you know, in this kind of research, you can control for those things and see if they soak up some of the effect that monotheism exerted.
Yeah, and I know the quantitative stuff here can be very crude, but when combined with a very theoretically compelling story, you really, I think, hammer home the argument that you're making here. And I want to turn to that now.
We've
determined that monotheisms do pretty well in terms of socio-political stability and duration and geographic expanse. Why is that?
Yeah, so as I said, you know, my hunch in terms of faith and socio-political stability, you know, those are old ideas. And I, you know, I was inspired by the turn of the century thinkers here. The thing that I add in the book, as you mentioned, is well, you know, faith is important. Some of the benefits, functional aspects that it brings to the table are important. But when we think about monotheism, especially with our economist hats on, can we see something even different, maybe an extra kick due to their monotheist nature? And my answer was yes, because of three aspects that I could identify when I look at a monotheism, especially the Abrahamic, you know, versions. One, you know, the ecclesiastical authority, if they, you know, are credible that they represent the one true God and one true religion, and the population basically subscribes to this service, then you have a huge advantage in terms of economics because you have monopoly power. Okay, because this ecclesiastical authority is the credible formal representative of that one true God, one true religion, now you've erected a huge barrier to entry. It's very difficult to penetrate that and tear down that, you know, authority. And it did happen in Europe, and we'll get to that, you know, and it was a watershed event in European history, obviously. But it's extremely difficult as, say, as opposed to polytheistic faith where, you know, even if there's an ecclesiastical authority representing a god, you can come up with another god, or there's another god that you represent, and you can steal market share, so to speak, in economics. So that, to me, was a huge advantage. And, of course, how do you get to that position of authority where you're selling the so-called credence good, right, where it's about the belief in the quality of the good of the population? That makes it credible. But once you have that entry barrier, there are two other aspects of monotheism that drew my attention in terms of, you know, providing social and political advantages. One was you have personalized exchange between the one deity and yourself, right? There's a one-to-one relationship in terms of your deeds in this material world and what the ramifications of that could be in the afterlife. And relatedly, in all these monotheistic one God, one faith religions, although you see them to some extent in other religions too, the belief in afterlife really affects your behavior in this world, right? It creates much more accountability. And again, in terms of mapping it back to economics terminology, I'd say you discount the future less, potentially. So these three aspects, to me, give an extra kick to monotheism that could explain why they had these social advantages.
The next question that you bring up deals with the role of cooperation in conflict, both within states and empires and between them as well.
Yes.
And here you have two very interesting hypotheses that I'd like you to explain the logic of. So what are those?
Yeah, so I mean, again, taking this idea, and this is where, in fact, what we started the program with, Herschel Grossman's ideas of political economy, the resource allocation between production and violence. This is where, in terms of the analytics, where they come into play. Because in terms of my thinking and the impact of monotheisms, it's true that basically, and this is based on some data that political scientists had unearthed in the 60s, we do have some evidence that, you know, societies that adhere to the same ideology, the same faith, they tended to confront less often. And if, you know, you had civilizations that subscribed to different faiths, that were on the other side of this one God, one faith duality, they did tend to confront each other more often and more frequently. And to me, this again is in part, you know, a manifestation of monotheism, the one God, one faith duality. And it will come into play when we look at how the Ottomans viewed Europe and their conquest patterns too. In other words, if you have a threat, an outside threat from another civilization, of course this could be existential. But when faith is involved, it not only affects the fervor with which the aggressive party could be fighting, but also the civilization on the defensive end as well. So I tried to take that idea and that hypothesis and apply it to the rest of the analysis in the book.
Makes a lot of sense as well. And what do you find there? Give us your empirical results here. And here you're primarily focusing on Christian Europe and the Ottoman Empire.
Yes, yes. So in order to basically talk about the results, let me very quickly tell you a little bit about the Ottoman Empire.
Okay.
So Ottoman Empire was an extremely successful empire built on conquest. It started in just the turn of the 14th century in 1299 in Anatolia, was a very minor, you know, beylik, a small, you know, city-state in the heart of Anatolia. And within 115 years, it grew so fast, it conquered so many territories, that it became one of the biggest empires, longest-lasting empires in the Middle East, North Africa, all of Arabian Peninsula, almost all of the eastern part of Europe, including the Balkans. So, you know, we can talk about the institutional aspects and you know, what made the Ottoman Empire special, but I'm going to point out three things here that's useful for our purposes and the book. One, historians have talked about the importance of the Gaza ideology as a driver of the empire. What is the Gaza ideology? Of course, in the West, and again, due to September 11 now, we almost all know the jihad, right? The jihadi perspective. The Gaza is very similar, except it has more connotations of an offensive strategy. Jihad is defending the Holy Land, right? It's more defensive. Gaza is more offensive. It's really teaching the ways of the God to the infidels and showing them the path to God and the true faith. So historians, very respectable historians like Jamal Khafadar at Harvard, you know, have written books on this and documented how the Ottoman Empire, one of the foundational pillars of the empire, was to promote Gaza once it was powerful enough. Number two, for this empire in particular, and many others during that era, we're talking about pre-nation states, pre-industrial revolution, what sustained the engine of growth was conquest. You had to conquer new geographies to extract some resources, appoint a mayor, and we talked about control, be it as flexible as it needs to be, but the engine kept humming based on territorial conquest, you know, and the Ottoman Empire was particularly good at this for a very long time. Finally, the third point is, and this is related, the Ottoman Empire at that point, especially the mid-15th, 16th centuries, was a force to be reckoned with. For about 200 years, you know, based on Gaza, first of all, everything else equal, they tended to want to conquer lands in the West, Christian lands, everything else equal. Number two, they were extremely good at this because compared to Europe, they were way ahead politically, economically, technologically. And for about 200 years, until the late 16th century, they don't even lose a battle against the Europeans. And this really colored how they grew, in the direction in which they grew, and so forth.
And that creates an interesting dynamic in Europe. And this is really the fascinating crux of your book, that what is going on in the Ottoman Empire is affecting what is happening in Christian Europe. And for the most part, when we study European history, we don't think about the Ottoman Empire until you get to the, you know, sick man of Europe, and then European imperialism expands there. And we tend to see European economic and socio-political development in isolation. But you're saying, no, that can't be the case here. Because again, the Ottomans are expanding. They're expanding pretty far up into the Balkans, Eastern Europe, the Battle of Vienna, they're right there at the gates of Vienna. What impact does the Ottoman Empire, and this is a very interesting period of time too, because you were coming into the 15th century and into the 16th century. That's a pretty critical time in Europe too. What goes on here?
Yeah, so, you know, given the Ottoman Empire's ideology, its prowess, and leaning towards the West in conquest, this whole era comes at a point where you have an important watershed in European history. Because we're talking about a couple of centuries prior to the Industrial Revolution, and right around the time when Martin Luther in 1517 comes with his 95 theses and nails them on the church door in Wittenberg. As you know, there are precursors. What makes this really interesting, and you know, historians have talked about this a lot and come up with theories about why did Martin Luther succeed in bringing down the Catholic Church monopoly that existed for thousands of years? It's an interesting question because there are, in Europe, there are precedents of challenges to the Catholic Church that go back a couple of centuries. We got the Hussites, the Luddites, basically, you know, movements in southern France and England that tried to challenge the Catholic Church in earlier eras, but they were almost all violently suppressed and successfully suppressed. So how is it that Martin Luther succeeded this time around was a very important critical question. The classic answer to this, and I in no way discount it, that it's important, the reason why Martin Luther succeeded was because of the printing press. The printing press enabled ideas of Martin Luther to spread through Europe and take hold. That's one credible theory. What's also true is that there was a much lesser known theory about this, and that basically elevated the Ottomans into the picture. And the most prominent of these ideas is again due to a Harvard historian, Fisher Gulati, which coincidentally was a professor at the University of Colorado for many years until he retired. He had a very small, short book on this topic solely devoted to the idea that perhaps Protestants benefited because of this big Ottoman threat, the Islamic threat to Europe. And others basically picked up on this idea. Goffman, Halil Inalcik, Sanford Shaw, McCulloch, you see in their writings, and I quote and cite all of these references in my book, these are all historians that took this idea seriously, that you have these big ideological divide between the Christian Europe, despite its all differences, internal differences, and quote-unquote a menace in the East that's basically superior technologically, economically, socially, that's chunking, you know, taking up land every spring and is right at the doorsteps of Europe, threatening the European civilization. So to me, you know, taking the ideas that we talked about so far seriously, this is a very important threat that perhaps when you're the Catholic Church or you're Ferdinand and Francis overseeing the Holy Roman Empire, and you see this uprising up north in the German areas challenging your, you know, political authority to some extent, but definitely the ecclesiastical authority, maybe you had to make a call. And basically the book first shows data that in fact, you know, looking at the patterns of conflict in Europe and the Middle East and what the Ottomans were doing, documenting that whenever the Ottomans had European conquest, intra-European confrontations and violence was subduing. And in particular, I even look at the timing, particular timing of the critical Catholic-Protestant wars and how that relates negatively to Ottoman-European conquest. So after documenting, again, taking Cleometrics seriously, after documenting that, you know, whenever the Ottomans were conquering land in Europe, which was often, there was a de facto peace in Europe is an important, you know, necessary condition that you'd want to see if you were taking this hypothesis seriously. The hypothesis that the Protestant Reformation benefited from this Islamic threat.
Yeah, it everything just kind of came together at the right point in time and right place in time, I guess, as well, too, is that you had the printing press, you had Martin Luther, and then you had the Ottoman threat pushing Northwestern into Europe, and you know, the Catholic Church says, yeah, we want to beat back these Protestants, but local princes and kings on the ground said, yeah, we got a bigger problem now.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, not only the, you know, Austrian-Hungarian Prince Ferdinand, who was Charles's brother, you know, overseeing the Holy Roman Empire, he was the one confronting the Ottoman threat the most. And there's the historical anecdotes and references are quite extensive in whenever he saw this threat, he went to his brother for help, but his brother, of course, you know, to him, this was a threat to his empire, but he was dealing with Francis and the French on a continuous basis. So he tried to help, but you know, it was limited. Then whenever Ferdinand tried to get help with the German diets basically said, sure, we can help, but how about you basically cut us some slack and recognize us? And in fact, the first siege of Vienna in 1529 really shook Europe to its core to some extent, because that's when all of this bargaining was set aside and everybody came to the defense of Vienna. And to me, that's a great anecdote that shows, you know what, if this existential threat is big enough, especially by an outside power subscribing to a different ideology, then maybe it's time to set aside our differences. And by the way, you know, I see precedents of this in even the modern era. You know, we talk about the late 60s and the Soviet space program and what that did to the U.S. and us in terms of our, you know, willingness to commit to some social programs, set aside our differences. Yeah. So it's the same idea.
Yeah, no, it's something that in political science we've examined quite a bit, and you bring a new light onto an era of history that people really haven't looked at that closely in terms of that thesis, that existential threat really does change the socio-political dynamics within a region. And so the crux of your book, and I think what you really bring to the table very well, is that the Ottomans really are an influential factor in the course of religious history and in the course of political history in the 16th and into the 17th century into Europe. So that people should be reading it just for that, because I think that is very important. But here's another question. Did the effect go the other way? Did Europe have an impact on the Ottoman Empire?
Yes, excellent question. You know, and this is really, you know, the fundamental $6 million question, right? If indeed these threats help internally to set aside differences and produce coexistence and maybe even spill over into our institutions, make them more inclusive, you know, and this is one reason why Europe took off. The classic natural question is, well, why is the Middle East still struggling, right? Didn't they face these threats? There are a couple of answers, and I'll admit none of them are, you know, perfectly satisfactory to me either. You know, one is we got to put things in perspective. Christianity dates 6 centuries farther back from Islam, right? So in a sense, the Islamic institutions, it's, you know, how they evolve is still taking shape, and in some ways it had a 6th century late start. So the evolution of even the Middle Eastern institutions could in fact evolve to become more inclusive, and it could well be because of external threats. Now, a classic example of, you know, an external threat, especially the Christian threat, uniting the Arab civilization does exist, and that's back to the First Crusade in 1095. The Islamic, you know, civilizations back then was under Salah ad-Din, after the First Crusade was so successful, they were able to gather again and basically successfully reconquer their holy land. So we have the precedence of it. The issue is, well, why didn't those kinds of reactions produce the institutional benefits that we see in Europe? There is no satisfactory answer to this. But I will say again, and this is what I do in the culminating chapters of the book, after documenting, of course, we just talked about how the Catholic Church monopoly was perhaps broken because of this ideological threat. But I do talk about then, well, could it have spilled into European institutions or individual behavior? We talk about that. But the final chapter of the book is really about the Middle East and the part that I know best, which is Turkey, Asia Minor, and how, you know, European threat affected Turkey. One thing that's really interesting when I get into that and the Turkish experience, and in fact I'm working on a project with Jared Rubin at Chapman right now on these ideas. Ottoman history again is very revealing in terms of how a civilizational decline affects your view, your perspective, your beliefs. Because I look at Ottoman history, and don't forget, they're the last revelation, they're the last one God, one faith religion, right? So, and they're extremely powerful for two and a half centuries. So to them, Europe is an afterthought. It's backward lands. You got to teach them. You got to conquer them and show them the right way. When Europe starts to take off, when we see first signs of, you know, European strength, at first, you know, there's denial, and this lasts a long time. There's denial that the Ottoman Empire, the Ottomans could learn anything from the infidel because, you know, they subscribe to the wrong faith. Now, once you start losing wars back to back, this denial becomes cognitive dissonance. You can't sustain it anymore. So then the next phase of reformation in the Ottoman Empire was conservative revival. The first kinds of, you know, reform aren't, okay, let's copy these people, they seem to know things better than us. The first almost instinct, and this is where I think beliefs and ideology are really paramount, the first instinct is almost always, well, we were so strong, so superior for such a long time, we abandoned our true you know, ways. Let's go back to that. Let's embrace that. So you see this conservative ideology, which is exactly what happened. The earliest reform attempts in the Ottoman Empire are very conservative, trying to go back. But you know what? Unfortunately, in the case of the Ottomans, the whole economic political game had changed, and we had the Industrial Revolution. So even that was the wrong thing to do. Next, third phase is you concede that something changed and these guys know better, and you try to emulate them. But at first, you try to limit it to the existentially important innovations, military technology in particular. So you saw adoption of new technologies only in the military realm. And finally, just before the empire was coming down, a wholesale recognition that, okay, you know, we have a lot to learn from these people. Maybe we should emulate them. To the extent that, you know, and this is where the cultural backlash that we see in Turkey and the Middle East is coming through, to the extent that that emulation becomes part of the emulation of things that are pretty trivial too, very cultural things.
Yeah, no, that's you describe very well fundamentalist movements and the procedures that, you know, societies go through there as well, which is universal to a lot of different societies and cultures.
Yeah.
The last thing that I want to talk about your book, and this is somewhat of a side note on the book, but one of the more interesting side notes, is the internal dynamics of the Ottoman Empire and something that you talk about, the harem ruling and the importance that queen mothers, I think they think of Valide Sultan, have in basically conditioning the rule within this very multi-ethnic empire. This I found was just absolutely interesting. So tell us about this, the harem hypothesis, as you call it.
Yeah, thank you. Well, again, you know, since I have the data to look at these things, and in trying to actually really tease out from the data the impact of the Ottomans on intra-European feuds, one of the peripheral things that I had to look at in terms of how the Ottomans, you know, whether the Ottomans, what went into how the Ottomans decided, right? Because back then, warfare was a very seasonal activity. You know, in the spring, the Ottoman armies were set on the road to conquest, and, you know, either they committed to fight in the west or the east, or some necessities dictated that, right? Whenever others initiated conflict. First, I document that in the case of the Ottomans, of most of the, especially early on when they were really powerful through the 17th century, 70% of the conflicts involved were initiated by the Ottomans, predominantly. So then the question is, well, how do they, when they're going to initiate conflict, and we know that conquest was an important driver of this empire, its sustainability, how do they decide whom to attack, who to attack, right? So on this, I turned to the institutions of the Ottoman Empire, the most important of which was the harem. Harem, of course, is the private quarters of the sultan, but it also holds the political and military hierarchy. So, interestingly, inside the harem, the mother queen, the Valide Sultan, is extremely powerful. She controls whom the sultan interacts with privately, and, of course, being the mother of the, you know, extremely powerful sultan, confers her with a lot of political authority. The other thing that's interesting here is that the Ottomans deliberately, after in the initial phases and for political control, they started to procreate only through concubines and slaves. So when you look at the history of all these mother queens, they have an incredibly rich ethnic religious background, including some Muslims like Turks among them. But if you look at the 31 sultans and their mothers, you have five of them that are Turks, four French, you know, four Venetian, Serbians, Greek, Polish, Russian, Albanians, Bosnians, Genoans. All these mothers were women captured in Christian lands, brought to the harem, converted to Islam, and they're part of the harem. And when, if they're lucky enough to procreate with the sultan, if they give birth to a son, then they can have no longer any contact with the sultan ever again. So you had, in the internal harem dynamics, you had these women with sons of the sultan, one of whom, through very random events, became deliberately random because of Ottoman succession policies, random succession through which one of the sons became the new sultan. The issue then is, well, these women had Christian backgrounds, and did that ever spill into how the Ottomans behaved? So in this, what I tried to look at, and again, using data, I tried to show some evidence that if and when a sultan had a mother with the Christian, most of the time Balkan descent, that sultan was more prone to fight in the east. And whenever, you know, he had a mother, basically that was of Muslim or Turkish descent, then those sultans tended to conquer infidel lands in the west.
This was just mind-blowingly fascinating for me, because your book, a big part of the book was this macro historical perspective, and then all of a sudden you have this chapter, and the methodology you use is very creative too. You have a list of all the sultan moms, and you think about the overlapping, how old was the kid when he became sultan, and you know, when did the mother die? I mean, very, very micro details here. So I was taken from macro historical story to this micro place and time where I'm sitting there thinking about, okay, what is going on in the palace here? You know, mom's coming up saying, hey, you know, sultan, you're thinking about going on the attack because it's the season of attack, but you know, why don't we just, you know, leave Europe alone this year, and why don't you kind of go out toward Persia? That would be the good place. And it was just very vivid in my mind, you know, something you wouldn't necessarily think of in an economic book, but you do it very well.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. And again, you know, it was basically an attempt to look at if the main theme of the book is ideology is important in explaining historical patterns of conflict. It was a natural place to look at. And of course, I cannot speak very confidently about the mechanisms, although, as you've seen, I tried to tease out whether interactions with this mom would be at the heart of this. Did mom play a role in dictating patterns of conquest, or was it just being born to a mom with a Christian background, and while you're raised, you hear stories, you know, you're given beliefs and values that are more sympathetic to the West, as opposed to not being exposed to those things.
Again, and this might not necessarily be ideology. We think of ideology as a very systematized the system of beliefs. But, you know, as you do, and this might be a first, political scientists out there, listen, you know, the thesis or the question is, does mom matter? You know, does what mom say actually matter? And you could think about this in the White House or in the French Parliament or anything like that. And I just think it's so cool. And you actually paint a very compelling story. And it people should just read it for at least that chapter, but for everything else as well.
Yeah, of course, the other interesting thing in all this is we're talking about the Ottoman Empire, a very paternalistic Islamic society, where you would expect, well, women were subordinated to many things, right? And it turns out not to be the case.
No, throughout history, moms play a big role. You're bringing the mom variable back in. You know, we've brought the state back in, taken the state back out. You're bringing mom back in, I guess, which is very cool. Let me finish up with this question about your research before we move on to the audio portion or the blues portion of our discussion today. And that is, you've been at this for roughly 10 years. As you mentioned, in 2005, you really start shifting focus and finding these questions to be very interesting. Over the course of that 10 years, have you changed your mind about anything? What have you really learned or taken away from all of this study?
Yeah, I'd have to say, you know, basically three headers on that. I'm gonna lump what I learned from this and what I'm still learning. I mean, obviously, it's an evolution, never ends. I'd lump it under three headers: the institutional context, the development context, and the geopolitical globalization context. So let me tell you what I mean by all this. I learned something, and basically, of course, priors are important. We all have certain beliefs, even in academia, right? We have a hunch, and as I told you at the beginning, you know, I really didn't subscribe to this very, you know, rudimentary view of how institutions, formal institutions, matter only, without any link or fluidity between what do we mean by institutions? I mean, isn't culture, beliefs, and formal institutions that we carry with us, aren't they important, and how do they map into the institutional context, right? Especially, as I told you, how when we think about institutions, even if it's just strictly political institutions, do we just think about domestic dynamics? And to me, what I learned, and hopefully what I'm trying to argue convincingly here, is that when you look at important moments of European history, right, external dynamics came to impinge upon internal institutions, and we can't ignore these things. And again, we talked about even modern examples of this, one of the most prominent of which that comes up in our modern American context is, the Soviet threat. So that's what I take from this, right? When we think about institutions, let's think about the external interactions and how perhaps beliefs and ideologies come to color those. Second, the development context. You know, economics is really built on the idea and the virtues of competition and non-zero-sumness, right? We believe that cooperation, free market interactions, and competition in those markets are really beneficial to the society as a whole. The apple pie is bigger based on these concepts. I mean, what I learned from this, if I take the book seriously, is that even ideological competition could be good, right? And we see, we've seen, of course, the downside of ideological competition, which is violence, right? Conflict based on religion exists still today painfully. That's the downside, but there were internal benefits of this religious ideological competition historically, and that's something perhaps we should take a little bit more seriously. Finally, I mentioned the geopolitical globalization context, and this is where I'm spending a lot more time these days in thinking about research. The forces of globalization, economic and political globalization, in my opinion, really favor religious ideologies. Some of the biggest evils of the last 20th century or earlier after the rise of nation states were due to nationalist ideologies, and we learned the benefits and the costs imposed by that. Now, to me, globalization is a force because it favors bigger and more integrated markets. Globalization is a force that really favors religious ideology. We see at some level that nationalistic ideologies have retrenched. We see a lot of countries that disintegrate, but there's integration at the economic realm. Well, to me, that really leaves the religious ideology without the competition of nationalistic ideology. And this is where I think, despite the controversies involved, this is the context in which we should think about Samuel Huntington's civilizational conflict ideas.
That is a really interesting idea, and I am going to have to follow where you are going on that, because it is, as you mentioned, it brings up the Huntington thesis, which a lot of people have dismissed in some regards, but I think you are positioned very well to bring a more formal economic aspect to this, and what you just said really piqued my interest. So we'll be following you on that. But right now, speaking of distinct cultures, as we mentioned early on, you are of Turkish descent, but you are a big fan of the blues, and you're in a blues band called Barrel of Blues. How did this mishmash of cultures ever come about?
Well, it's not unrelated to a lot of the things that we talked about thus far. Combined with my family history, I'm Turkish, obviously, but my mother is ethnically Turkish, born in Brooklyn, New York, raised there, and moved to Turkey in the 50s after meeting a Turkish student studying in the U.S. So part of my family is American, and so I was always, involved with Western culture, pop culture and things like that. But more importantly, and this is where, the topic of the book is relevant, modern Turkish Republic, we talked about how basically reforms come about, right? Denial, copying to some extent, and so forth. But the modern Turkish Republic was a statement, and some people in Turkey reject that today, for good or bad. The modern Turkish Republic was built on conceding that the West was superior, and there are many things that we should basically, emulate, not necessarily become totally dependent on the West, but there were virtues of, especially I would call, enlightenment values. So the Turkey that I grew up in, in many ways, including culture, was Western-oriented. So growing up in Turkey in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, especially in urban areas, middle-class urban areas, Western music was huge. British invasion took the U.S. by storm, but it was also big in Turkey. I'm a little bit younger than the the 60s generation, but, you know, the Jimmy Pages and Gary Moores and the Rolling Stones and Queen, Gary Moore, all those guys were huge influence. And I grew up, like a lot of kids, you know, dreaming about becoming a guitar player and making a living. From that, I was in bands, started playing when I was 14. I was in bands in Turkey, lots of interesting stories I could tell there too. Then life intervened. I put everything on hold for about 10 years, but the last 10, 12 years I've been back at it and I just love it. We have a great scene here in Denver, musical scene, blues scene. And I'm, you know, proud and happy to be part of it.
And the music is great. We're going to point people back to the Barrels of Blue website. In fact, when you log on to it, it has this really great song that plays there. And I just left the website up and listened to the song several times over. But you supplied us with one of your own creations, and it's one that you do everything on. You play guitar, you program the drum track on everything, and it's called you're going to have to pronounce this for me.
Yeah, Mukarnas.
Mukarnas.
Yeah, exactly.
And you call this arabesque blues. Explain what that means in the genesis of this.
So arabesque is to the Middle East what blues is to the Mississippi Delta, right? I mean, arabesque is the music of the downtrodden of the Middle East, and with these very Middle Eastern Mediterranean flavors. And, you know, there was a strand in Turkey, again, dating back to the 70s, of very, you know, very influential, great rock music that had these tones, Middle Eastern tones. And, you know, later on, Led Zeppelin, Sting, all those guys, U2, you hear all those Mediterranean, very Middle Eastern flavors, even in their music, the least of which, you know, not the least of which is Kashmir by Led Zeppelin, you know, the modern versions where they bring in the Egyptian band, you know, Middle Eastern band into the fold. So this was an attempt, you know, my own creation of trying to come up with a very arabesque Middle Eastern rock song. And of course, we know rock is nothing but blues.
You know it. And so let's go ahead and hit it. This is Mukarnas by Murat Egan, a one and a two and a... All right. Oh, that was excellent. We got to have you back on the program to not only follow some of your research into some of these other areas that we've been talking about, but just to hear some more of your songs here. Murat, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Tony, thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.